Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and Happy New Year! My guest this week is Stephen McCarthy, an actor and filmmaker whom you might know from his appearances on The Strain, Murdoch Mysteries, Defiance, Rain, and Copper, among others. The short film he directed and stars in, O Negative, was chosen for Canada's Top 10 Film Festival and screens at the TIFF Bell Lightbox at 9 p.m. on Friday, January 15th. It is very good, and you should go see it if you're able. Steve picked Jonathan Glazer's stylish thriller Under the Skin, an almost experimental science fiction work that casts Scarlett Johansson as an alien driving around Glasgow, charming and luring single men for unknown purposes. An adaptation of Michel Faber's 2000 novel that abstracts the book's characters and even its premise nearly beyond recognition, it's one of the most striking genre films in a decade filled with inventive idiosyncratic examples. And given how Stephen treats the horror genre in O Negative, I was really curious to see what he'd have to say about this. This is someone else's movie. We should probably at least open with some idea of what O Negative is, because I realize I don't really...
Yeah, right.
Because we're talking about it like...
Yeah, you're talking about... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But, it is someone else's movie.
Yes. But as far as O Negative, you know, like, how would you... I got it. When you told me you wanted to do Under the Skin, I immediately thought, oh, perfect. That makes so much sense based on your short film, mm-hmm. O Negative. So for the people who are listening that haven't seen it, how would you...
They can send me an email and I'll send it to them. candlesr4@gmail.com.
I'm terrified of spoiling anything for anyone. So how would you pitch it?
The thing it says on the TIFF trailer site is that, you know, a young woman and the man who takes care of her take shelter at a roadside motel and find ways to feed her addiction. Right.
That is what it's about.
It's a 15-minute. It's almost silent, which I think is one of the reasons why I realized in retrospect that Under the Skin would be a kind of a great model. What was the question?
Just how, you know, I guess how I could position O Negative without actually spoiling it.
I've learned all these terms. It's my first film, so I've learned all these terms kind of along the way as people sort of have talked to me about it, or industry professionals have sort of, helped me to position it. It's an elevated genre film, I guess is what people call it. I mean, for me, it came from a conversation where I was sitting with my girlfriend and we had just seen Fright Night, the original, at the Review, and we're at the local next door for a beer. And I jokingly just said, someone should put you in a vampire movie. and she, at this point, had never done a film. O Negative is her first film. And it started out as being like, well, what would it be like? And we were like, what are the vampire films we love? And let the right one in. Like I said, I'm not afraid to admit how much of an influence... I think genre is exciting and fun, because for me, it was a mask that I was putting on. I never set out... My aims were very modest. I'm a actor and a theater maker, and I run rock and roll bands, and I do a lot of things, and I translated a play that's going to be done next year. So I kind of go with whatever I'm excited about at that moment, and so far it seems to be working out for me. But this was just kind of her and I talking about something that was a funny thing that we'd both be in. And when I came around to writing it, I had this one idea about this man and woman linked by a kind of a tubes and a machine, and I had this image of, you know, blood flowing out of one person into another person's mouth, mm-hmm. and that stayed with me for about a year as just this kind of random thing I'd written down. And at this point, I was still under the impression that, you know, I probably would never make a movie. It was maybe something I'd do when I was older and smarter and new things, and had everything figured out. And so when I made the movie, it just came out of this impulse to be like, fuck it, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to make it next month. And that's what happened. I wrote my friend and said, remember that motel up on Highway 17? And he wrote me back. This is a friend of mine I've known since kindergarten, and said, you can stay at the house. I'll cook. Karina and the kids will love it. Oh, that's lovely. That was the first yes. And Alex said yes. And Cabot said yes. And my friend Stefan Lafleur said yes to editing it. Like, the whole thing just kind of grew out of these like 20 and 30 year relationships of friends who were all like, sure, Steve's gonna make this thing, it's sort of cool, and so that's it. So it probably doesn't answer your question, but it's like a 15 minute genre sort of vampire addiction tension exercise.
Yes.
And its aims were very modest, and so to have it recognized in this way, the whole way it's been totally bizarre and strange and inspiring. It makes me want to do more things.
Yeah, and you mentioned a feature version. Are you actually expanding it?
Yeah, I mean, we...
Is that news? Should we not?
No. Like I said, I make a lot of things, and this has energy behind it, and you know, part of the... Yeah, I don't think you have to look too far at the... If and when you see a negative, listeners, you don't have to look too far to understand this as sort of addiction metaphor, and I think... The whole idea, you know, like you've talked about it before, the vampire stuff can stand in for anything, really.
Sure.
Yeah. But in you know, for me personally, I think it definitely was a place where I was like, how do I continue to make things and also live and survive? You know, I love collaborating with people. I love making creative things. How do I do that in a way? You know, I have a 10-piece band. Like, that doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? So there was something about the idea of giving your blood to something, which I think anyone who's, you know, who has a kid or a job that they care too much about or, you know, can identify with. Like, I'm a real believer in the process makes the product. It's the way in which the work is being done that will determine whether or not it's a worthwhile thing, usually from my understanding of things so far.
And Under the Skin is in its own way a process film. Like, it's a film about someone doing a job, even though we don't really understand what that job might be at first.
Yeah, true.
Even at the end, I'm not sure what's going on. It's so elliptical.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's sort of marvelous in that way. Mm-hmm. But it also ties to O Negative, mm-hmm. which is a film about someone doing a thing that isn't immediately... Well, it's inscrutable. It's not immediately scrutable to the audience and how that plays.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of unashamed to wear the influences on my sleeve because my initial kind of hopes for what O Negative were just a process for me to learn, you know, right. to sort of go, I'm going to learn how to...
Dexter, stop molesting him.
Right in the ears.
Nice. Stop molesting our guest. Yes. Fine. Apparently Dexter will be more present in 2016.
Yeah, I think this is good. Starting off well. I saw Under the Skin, and, you know, it's funny to sort of look back and realize that maybe I was thinking about becoming a filmmaker for a lot longer than I kind of, like, consciously was planning to do it.
Yeah.
But when I saw that movie, I was like, that's a movie that I want to make. That kind of movie is the movie that I want to make. And I don't even know if I can name exactly what it was, but I think it was the ellipticalness, the idea that you have to sort of complete a lot of what's happening, and it's not completely explained, and you're kind of completing the story for it, and nothing's handed to you, and yet it sort of sits between these worlds of very real worlds, like the world of her picking up the men, and the way in which that process was accomplished with hidden cameras and all that stuff is very, very... there's no sets, there's no lighting, you know, he's created a process whereby he is under incredible constraints to make an alien movie in a documentary kind of style.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the world of the alien world of kind of the initial opening sequence and the house, you know, where she brings the victims, you know, that is like about as far from a real documentary film as you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
You know, like,
one third of it is dogma and the other two thirds are austere, high contrast Kubrickian.
Yeah. 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 Which I don't know. It felt like experiencing music or a poem where you're being asked to be sort of complicit in this story and to complete it for yourself. And I loved that. I loved that it wasn't afraid to sort of be at once austere and horrible and very kind of poetic. You know, I think of the sequence where she's laying in the snow and we cut to the the sort of the pine trees sort of moving slowly. Mm-hmm. It's everything. It looks a little unreal because it's just a different way of looking at the world, you know, like.
Yeah, and there are so few scenes in the film that are not from her perspective. Mm-hmm. And I even hesitate to use the character's name because it's never used in the film.
Does she have a name?
I believe it's Iserly in the book.
Mm, oh, yeah.
Which I went and read after the fact, and have you read it?
I didn't read it, no. I kind of, when I looked at the behind-the-scenes stuff, it made me go, oh, there was such a journey from... It would be neat to look back at it now. But, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, it's kind of remarkable. It's a completely internal novel.
Mm.
It's her perspective. It's her thoughts, almost. It's not first person, but it is her journey.
Mm.
captured for the narrative, and it's everything we see is seen through her eyes. She's not the sort of creature that Johansson is playing.
Mm.
She's playing a kind of a weird bird-like person who's surgically been transformed into a human and not very well. There's a constant thing about how her eyes are too small, so she has to wear these big Coke bottle glasses, and she has to walk a certain way, and she's in pain all the time. They're completely different from what we see.
Oh, neat. Like a kind of a malformed Frankenstein.
Sort of, yeah. And she's just a functionary for a larger story, for a larger operation, as she is in the movie, but the operation is detailed. We get to see it. There's this giant underground farm.
Yes, it's more
harvesting people.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Harvesting males, castrating them, force feeding them, and then sending them off. I mean, it's much more about factory farming
in
a really, really weird way,
which
none of that makes it into the film. We don't even really understand what processes are going on.
Mm-hmm,
But yeah, we don't understand. In the film, we don't understand. We're not allowed to understand really what's happening to people or to her, which is why it is so incredible to me. It's just you're pulled into the possibilities of what you're seeing without actually ever really being granted an understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to put myself back in the mode of the first viewing because, you know, in those sequences where it's kind of like this weird, you know, the blood is moving somewhere. There's this idea of kind of like a conveyor belt, and even in the first sequence where she's being built, you know, I'm kind of trying to detach myself from what I've now listened to in commentary and in sort of analysis of it, and to put myself back in that view, because I guess you know, a lot of people have said to me like, "What the hell was that movie?" And I am constantly hoping to sort of change people's minds who sort of feel that way. But I guess you really have to be willing to put yourself in a place of, "I am on a ride that I don't understand, and I'm okay with not understanding." If you're the kind of person who is not okay with a bunch of images happening to you and then trying to put them together later, then you might not enjoy this experience, I guess.
Yeah, I've had people tell me that they hated it because it was a puzzle movie and that's no fun.
Yeah, right.
But
I love that.
That's great. Like, that's what you do. That's what you do in a movie anyway. You're just seeing images and sound and figuring out what they mean. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
It's not that much harder to sort of lean forward and pay attention.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I saw it theatrically. I missed it at TIFF. Glenn Sumi caught it for us and was raving about it. I couldn't get to it. I think actually I saw The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby instead. And couldn't go to Under the Skin, which was right afterwards. I can only imagine what it would have been like to go from that to Under the Skin, which is an equally singular movie experience, just completely different. I mean, it's cold where Eleanor Rigby is warm, and it's austere and sharp where Eleanor Rigby is handheld and lived in, but that doesn't make it any less powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I caught it the following April, I guess, whenever it finally opened. I went to the press screening here and loved it. And was just blown away. And I managed to avoid learning anything about it because that's my thing.
Did you know it was an alien movie or
anything?
I knew
it was science fictional.
Science fictional,
came out during TIFF, that everybody was saying Scarlett Johansson's an alien driving around Glasgow. And yes, but that's so...
It doesn't really prepare you. Yeah.
So much more.
I saw it. I'm so glad. I don't even know what finally motivated me to get out, but it was only playing at the Carlton, and it had been a busy time, and me and Alex went to the Carlton, and I'm so glad I saw it on the big screen, because when I did rent it in my prep for O Negative, I was really aware of how much the sound had done the heavy lifting of the movie.
Yeah.
In my process of making O Negative, I also kind of realized that was a big touchstone in terms of soundtrack, in terms of sound design, that way in which that movie worked emotionally with what the music was doing, and sort of making the alien world present in this otherwise sort of like almost cinema verite kind of look to the movie. I'm so glad that I'd seen it with that full experience of those speakers, of cinema speakers, even, you know, the Carlton. I think with the Carlton, they got redone and they got great speakers in there. So
it was post-Reno,
but yeah, that was, you know, smallish screen, but seeing it with that music, when I watched it again at home, which I don't have a huge and amazing setup or anything, I was aware of how lacking in emotion that experience would have been if someone to see it on Netflix or something like that, to see it in another way. I was just grateful that I had actually made it to the movies to see it.
Yeah,
to get that full, you know, because you watch something a different way when you're in a theater than when you're at home as well.
You're
there's no other distractions. You've made the decision to be there with that movie, and I think with this movie you really have to sort of decide to stay with it and to let it sort of wash over you.
Yeah, you have to be locked in with it, I think. And, you know, I can make the argument about anything, like aesthetically, is improved by total concentration of focus. But Jonathan Glazer seems to only work in that sort of total immersion. I'm not a huge fan of Birth, but...
Me neither. No,
I agree that, you know, it works in the theater more effectively.
It's funny. I wish I had seen that movie in a theater, because that was the same thing I felt, is that it was a Polanski light kind of riff and a great concept, like a really interesting concept. But who knows? You know, maybe not the right actress to sort of pull that kind of idea off. Or to me, when I saw Under the Skin, having seen Sexy Beast and Birth, and you know, it's I was not blown away by either of them in the way some people talked about Sexy Beast and looking back at now, having been so impressed by Under the Skin, by the decision making, and sort of investigated so much of what Glazer went through with his process in the way he made this movie, it's interesting to me that those are the three movies that he's made.
Yeah.
And I can't quite put it together what his world is, but I can't wait to see what he does next, having done this. I feel like he went, you know, I heard him speaking in an interview saying that, you know, he would never have been able to make this movie 5 years ago, in terms of the size of cameras and in terms of all those decisions about shooting real people and shooting, you know, I mean, this movie early on, I think, had two characters. I don't know if that's in the book as well.
Well, the motorcyclist is more present. I guess you could say.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
I mean,
One point in the script there was like Brad Pitt, or they were a couple. Like there was a whole idea of the two of them being these sort of perfect weird humanoids, and I mean, for me now in my own crazy world of writing the O Negative feature, like it's really interesting to hear someone go talk about how they had a book, they had a thing that they were starting from in terms of a launching point, and to arrive at something so completely different, and to even hear what the sort of turning points were along the way when they realized, no, this was just about, it had to go back to being a one person movie, and they repatched, you know. I love the idea of Jonathan Glazer meeting up with Brad Pitt and being like, I'm sorry, it's not going to work out. Maybe the next one.
Yeah, go make another Oceans movie. I'll get back to you.
Yeah. There's still time.
And I can sort of see Pitt figuring in to the movie as made, although now, of course, he's twice her age, so that would be weird too, although that would still be, like, visually, it's not something we're not used to. You can expect to see an older man and a younger woman in movie star roles.
Yeah.
So that could still have been a commentary on that. But yeah, I can't conceive, even after reading the book and seeing the other ways in which the story plays, I can't conceive of that version. And yes, the dog is asleep again.
There you go. Snoring. That's good. That's not Norman snoring.
Every episode. I'm sorry. And you have.
It's a nice
asleep.
Sort of undertone to the. Yeah. Like, it's the soundtrack.
Yeah. If anybody does know how to remove dog snoring from audio podcasts, please contact me. Someone else's movie at gmail.com. It's the nature of Under the Skin and of O Negative too. I mean, the idea of making stories about, if not supernatural, then at least extranatural, uncanny things. Happening to people who we immediately identify with as humans because they're put in front of us and they're the protagonists.
Yeah, right.
There's a really bizarre tightrope walk that I use tightrope walk too much. But there is a really bizarre request of the viewer in terms of identification in Under the Skin, where we literally watch Johansson or whatever Johansson is, absorbs someone else. We're watching her take her clothes, we're watching her take her identity, and then just leave, and we never find out what happens to the corpse or what happened beforehand. There's just this event that starts the film. We basically start the movie when Johansson becomes aware, to the point of that incredible opening sequence, which everyone thinks is spaceship stalking and Kubrickian weirdness. And the strange vocalizations of what apparently is somebody being force-fed language that she almost won't use. We're given so much information that's so abstract, and then this is the person you're going to be watching for the next hour and a half.
And you know, when I saw it, I didn't even clue in, because the way that it's shot with the body on the ground and the naked body, I had to wait until the second viewing to realize it was actually Scarlett's body. It was unclear to me what the idea of what this process was. Going from body to body or whatever it was.
You know? Only when she emerges dressed did I actually put all that together
in the first
viewing, because it is so. And maybe that's just why people tuned out. It's too aggressive an intro, but I don't think it is. I think it's amazing you're picked up and thrown into this world.
I wonder if some of that too is him going back to his music video world of trusting the fact that you don't have to give the story, you can do people will supply a lot of the story when you just supply some the images, and they'll complete it for you because they're in the mode of, oh, this must be the hero. They will sort of give over to going, okay, so what's their cause, what's their, you know. But you may be right. I mean, it is so much at the beginning that it takes so long for you to get into kind of the first dates, like the first idea of, okay, this hunter, you know, like, and even then, of course, you're like, what the?
Yeah.
It's Glasgow, you know, it's such a, listening to these guys who, some of them you can't even understand. I've been to Glasgow and I'm familiar with that accent, but hearing some of those guys speak, you know, even that is kind of inscrutable in an interesting way. So,
which works for her if she is genuinely not from here, as the, what is it? It's all prelude. It's all the bait for the trap. And her selection process in the book, they actually get into detail on her selection process. She's making sure they're single, she's making sure they're not expected tonight. Like, it's all about short-term grabbing. And none of that really matters in the movie, because if you present me with a scene in which someone is tempted by Scarlett Johansson, the movies have taught me that they will go with her. So it's even more streamlined. And then you get the black puddle or black water sequence, whatever that is, which is repeated a number of times and is not in the book. In the book, there's a little needle in the seat that stings them and knocks them out.
Oh, neat.
That's all there is. So they
have to steal that.
Yeah. Well, no one else is using it.
Yes.
But so now, currently, the film presents it as something that is completely unintelligible to us. That's probably not really happening. But it's gorgeous and weird and seductive in a way that probably mirrors how the men are processing it. But again, you only get these sequences after this rumbling handheld or mounted camera work, where it's so completely relatable and normal and people-y that it instantly, just to pivot off into that alien landscape again, it's like what the D-Box chairs are supposed to do. They're just sort of yanking you from space to space.
The what?
Oh, D-Box. It's this incredibly dumb idea. It's basically personal sense around. For something like The Fast and the Furious, you can be lurched from side to side when the cars turn.
Sounds horrifying.
I don't really... Yeah. It has never worked for me that way.
Right.
But Under the Skin is the kind of movie that feels like it could be. A proper vehicle for that, because it gives you the psychological sense of being yanked.
Sound is so well used in that film. I mean, to me, like I said, there's the picture, and even when I make theater, sound design is the one thing that I would never sacrifice. I could do a play with, you know, a light bulb and an actor, and no set, no costumes. And I would still make the fabric of the room sound design, because that's the thing that links the emotional world of what the performer is giving you with you. It's actually putting you in the same room. Like the sound waves are traveling all around you, and to me, especially making my own film when I was watching it and making the edit, and that whole process was incredible. But it was only when I put the sound back that I felt again like an audience of my own script, kind of thing, that I could right. feel that emotional connection, and that was really exciting to me. And Under the Skin definitely taught me kind of how deep that relationship could be. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of the black pool sequences in the house when the first victim is brought back and sees and we see the other victim right. floating, and that sound design is so, I'm going to use your word, uncanny. Like, we hold our breath
yeah.
with even though the person is breathing underwater, which is strange. All these things are happening that we don't quite understand. And then there's a sound when the other body bag, skin bag, kind of pops.
Yeah.
And it is sickening beyond belief. Like, it's the strangest. And because I was thinking about it, I went back and listened to that sound to go, why did that strike such a chord in me? And I mean, there's a whole thing on everyone should get the DVD, because there's those extended analyses from every key artist and the sound designer talking about how uncompromising Glazer was in, you know, there was no sound that was not from Glasgow. You know, they were field artists. They were paid and they were given time to go out and make sure that they had all the fabric sound-wise of this entire world, of this city, and the sounds of that city. And in creating the sounds like the ones they made, you know, they weren't... It sounds like they were given such a deep priority in terms of what their process was going to be yeah. that they were able to do things that are just it's so of a piece, the film. Like, it really is, like I say, the process makes the product, and I feel like Glazer understands sound at such a deep level. It was a good lesson for me.
Yeah, it's unlike, just the confidence in that scene is unlike anything I've seen mm-hmm. from him. Telling a story through an aesthetic rather mm-hmm. than dialogue or even performance in some ways. Like, a lot of O Negative is just the sides of people's bodies or the arc of a jaw or mm-hmm. something. It's kind of amazing to be able to draw people into that. And Under the Skin functions a lot of it in the same way. It's all faces mm-hmm. that aren't quite head on. They're mm-hmm. they're not direct. Or in the case of an actor with a facial deformity, mm-hmm. someone who we can almost not read at all.
Yeah. Right.
And it's just really striking that you could pull that off as well, because it feels like the kind of thing that would be really difficult.
Hmm.
Certainly watching Under the Skin the first time, I was amazed at how Glazer uses Johansson's, perfection is the wrong word, but, you know, like, she's aesthetically very, very pleasing.
Yeah, yeah.
Her, you know, she's her face is symmetrical, her body is curvy. All of these things that she uses as a movie star.
Yeah.
And rarely
as a womanly actor, movie star, right? Too, yeah. which is nice and seemingly rare these days.
Yeah, and here those are used as elements of performance in a way that she's not allowed to do very often.
Yeah.
Like, more often than not, Scarlett Johansson, because I was going back and realizing, like, she's been around forever
mm-hmm.
at this point. She made a... I had this joke about a terrible movie she made called The Perfect Score in 2001, I think, and it's Chris Evans is in it, and it's Captain America and the Black Widow as terrible nice. College students nice. Cheating on exams.
Nice.
But I, like, she wasn't even a new face then. Uh-huh. She'd made Ghost World already, or she just released it.
And the Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah, she's not new. Like, mm-hmm. she's been around for 20 years at this point. And
it's funny, even in the Coen Brothers movie, she plays...
Bates.
She plays jailbait. She plays, like, you know, it's funny how someone's hit can sort of be there from the very beginning.
Yeah, and she's in The Horse Whisperer, right? Like, that
right.
was one
yeah,
of her
yeah,
first
yeah.
movies. That's yeah. that's over 20 years ago now. And Under the Skin finds a way to use what you could cynically describe as the Scarlett Johansson package as elements of performance that you can't not notice, and you have to appreciate the way that, you know, like, you're drawn into her pauses and the way she positions herself, because mm-hmm. she's presented first off right away as something that is to be examined very, very closely. Like, she's not one of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there is something kind of remarkable about the idea that these guys in Glasgow don't recognize Scarlett Johansson because they simply wouldn't expect to see her.
I know.
There's no coaching, right? Yeah. They weren't, the whole concept of that was...
It's hidden cameras.
Go pick people up.
Yeah.
They don't know...
Yeah, PAs would be in the back of the van ready to jump out and have people sign releases. I mean, it's bonkers. It's incredible.
It's incredibly ballsy to even try to do that.
And how, I mean, how awesome a challenge and a wonderful kind of thing for Scarlett to have been accepted and being like, we're going to put you into the world. You're going to be in, you're going to be with these people and having to improvise and follow them and see if you can actually coax them into your vehicle and have a scene with them.
Yeah.
And then Glazer talks about, I listened to an interview, there'd be days where they would be like, and they didn't get the release. You know what I mean? Like there'd be days where they'd be like, fuck, we got the best footage of that guy. And then he said, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I can imagine the Glaswegians who were like, you know, go fuck it. You know, like, no, go to hell. Like,
I imagine that some of them were just like the scene with the women would be just people yelling, hey, that's Scarlett Johansson talking to someone.
Right.
And you destroy the whole thing. Like, it would just be ruined.
Yeah.
And instead you have to, I guess you could take some of the background audio out if it came to that. But the idea of this, the purity of these scenes, how this is just happening and it has like an A-list movie star who's made...
Who's trying to just pick up men.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I know.
The thing that everyone presumes that she could do very easily.
Yeah.
And then just running into these weird situations where that simply isn't... Like, the world isn't going to do what she wants.
Yeah, yeah.
The character rather than Scarlett Johansson. But it also overlaps with the illusion that movie stars can get anything they want. And all of that is just... It's... The text of it is so interesting. And then the subtext is more interesting still.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, he's so aware of the instruments that he's working with. And I think you're right. I think he's somehow understands that our collective obsession with beauty, with sexuality, with young female sexuality especially, with the idea of the danger of what it means to put for a young woman to be doing this event, all of us, it kind of, and also because she's Scarlett Johansson, so she's already an alien to us. She is already something to be inspected. And so the way in which he is making the viewer contemplate the idea of sort of uniqueness, of of sort of like uber humans, you know, this idea of people who are more than what we are as sort of pedestrians going about our business.
Yeah.
I think he's using all of those things to, like, he describes it as the alien lens to sit in that world of, you know, because as the movie progresses and, you know, we know, you know, that last shot of her looking at the Scarlett Johansson face in her own hands, the alien revealed, you know, which it's funny because as I was thinking about it, I was like, what would I have left out? You know, and then that might have been shot. You know, I think for me, that I just remember the recoil of feeling like, I don't want to see the monster. Like, I don't want to see the monster.
So it's not the contemplation of the face. It's the reveal of what's...
Well, inside. Also, the reveal of actually what's inside.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it was like, that shot is the theme. Like, you're hitting the theme. But it makes you look back at all the scenes where she is nude and she's got the lamp and she's examining her breasts and her body and adoring herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's putting us in the world of, you know, of the alien gaze. We've started to see the world through her eyes. So it doesn't seem exploitive. It just seems like natural to go look at her, like, just to appreciate and adore, and you know, he's making us have those questions over and over again, and manipulating us in the right way, you know, the extent that he's then put the exact opposite thing in the movie. He's visually represented horror. Like, what does it mean to be this man, this deformed person, and then for her to not treat him any differently, and to not see him any differently, and even to some extent for him to be the one to be allowed to be free.
Affects her. Yeah. And it is kind of amazing because what appears to be compassion from her side is still like, he's being harvested. He's there to be meat.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I guess it wouldn't be... It would
right,
be,
how
be
wonderful for him. Yeah, yeah, but we put ourselves in the position of, you want why to, him?
Yeah. You know, like, and you want it to be, oh, he's finally seeing someone show him empathy or compassion. And, of course, we have no idea what his life is. We're just all... We're imprinting whatever it is on mm-hmm, him mm-hmm. that we have and inferring from there. But it's just such a... Yeah.
Such a smart... It's a... And very... I mean, I found it like... God, like, I just felt so complicit mm-hmm. in the movie all of a sudden. Like, holy fuck, where yeah. is he going with this? Like, yeah. that person is... That's not makeup. You yeah. know, you just inherently...
Well, when you're watching
know
a movie
that.
About aliens, you're assuming that this will be a stunt. And yeah. it quickly, very clearly isn't.
Yeah.
And, yeah, then yeah. you're just drawn in even further.
Yeah.
And this is...
For having to commit to that, to me, is just so... You know, it puts you in a kind of like, in a complicity in almost in a performance art kind of way. You're responsible for this man yeah. now in the car.
Yeah.
By watching the movie.
Yeah, it feels like what Michael Haneke keeps saying he's trying to achieve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like if you can make it through his movie, he's failed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he's trying to repel you, but mm-hmm. that doesn't have the same. Gut pull.
No, like to me, that's sophomoric. That's the kind of that's a stunt to me. Like
yeah,
I can feel that. Yeah. Whereas when I actually do feel complicit, that's a manipulation that I didn't expect, and you know, that I'm not being sort of like, are you yeah. still with me here?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like in whatever.
Well, funny games,
which is the
ultimate. Misunderstanding of the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, oh, you stayed? You must be a terrible person.
Or like, Gaspar Noé. You know, there's some of that. It feels a little bit like a French, like, I don't know. I don't know.
It's the European dismissal?
Yeah, yeah. Or like, I'm putting the artist above the audience rather than I feel like what Glazer does in this movie especially. It's just, he doesn't even let you understand yeah. why. Because he's playing with all the things that we talked about. Celebrity, beauty, and also in the shots, you know, he's playing with reality television.
Yeah,
you know, he has constructed the process to emulate what we have now come to understand as reality. You know what I mean? The idea that somehow hidden cameras and all these things are kind of they're a part of our fabric of our lives and yeah. part of a fabric of our understood. Main levels of entertainment. The main thing I would say that when I switch channels, when I have cable and I'm in you know North Bay Hotel filming a movie and I'm switching around, I cannot believe how little scripted stuff there is on television. Yeah. Even though we're living in the golden age of cinema, but on the regular channels, it's mostly you know reality television. And the fact that he made the process go to a place with a Hollywood star, where they are so on the line as to sort of hope to create a scripted or whatever, you know, like
right.
They're gonna carve this out in editing. To me is just so massively brave and so massively smart. I can't even believe it. But
yeah.
what it does is it sort of gives it plays on that level of going, this is a real situation.
Yeah,
you kind of give it that extra thing because you can feel that this is just a guy, you know, on the side of the road giving directions.
Yeah.
Until he's in the car,
yeah.
and then he's in the house, and then he's just a naked, you know, with his penis.
Yeah.
You just feel. Glazer playing on that idea so that he can then go, well, what you know, his whole theme of
mm-hmm.
what does it actually mean to be a human being?
Yeah.
What is this? What are the sounds of it? Like when you hear that sort of that panoply of kind of weird voices that she hears when she's in the car, she hears the baby crying, like
yeah.
all these different things with the ocean. Like
yeah, well, he's just, we didn't even get to the ocean.
Oh yeah,
Jesus Christ!
I don't even understand how that scene was even. Physically,
I mean, with
the dog and the fucking. I have no idea how they shot that.
I just assume there were digital safety wires on everything.
Maybe
they took them out.
Maybe, yeah,
because, that's you know,
but still,
it doesn't.
You're a dog in 15 foot swells,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
It doesn't
like,
feel right.
It doesn't feel right.
It feels like genuine terror.
And he just sits there with that shot of the baby and the dog and the. Yeah, and he makes you go, why
is this happening? What am I getting from it?
Yeah, as a viewer,
member,
yeah. and also, what does it matter?
Yeah,
if these people die or not, you know, or, you know, like.
And you think, I mean, that's the other thing too. It cuts away with the baby crying, and it's sort of merciful because you can assume it's desolate, but it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And then later there is that little bit on the radio where the corpses are being recovered. It's like, oh no, that's right, we're not getting out of this. Nobody gets off the hook.
Yeah,
and nobody gets off the hook. I mean, the whole point of the ending is that it's a misunderstanding that, like, she gets what she wants as a harvester. She's killed because she's revealed because she's attracted to someone, and she tries. You know, she spends the whole movie trying to draw men in.
Yeah.
Finally succeeds, although for a different reason. And yeah, she gets what she wants, is a little oversimplified. But she finally accomplishes the thing that she's been teasing for the purposes of luring men for the entire movie, and that's what gets her killed. So it's...
You mean this idea that she's going to get raped kind of thing?
Well, the idea that she tries to seduce someone and then her confrontation, like, you know, the reason she's found out is because physically she's not capable of the thing she's trying to do.
Mm. Yeah.
And it becomes a rape scene in a really weird way. But it started somewhere else, and...
Well, it's funny. I mean, there's so many different sexual kind of...
Implications. Yeah, by the time we get there.
By the time we get... Yeah, I mean, that first crisis is knowing that I'm not human in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can't, there's no access.
Yeah.
You know, and
they both understand that horror at the same time. Mm-hmm. That really bizarre, for everything we've seen, that's the first moment that feels like Cronenbergian body horror is happening.
Yeah.
Because it's something that we don't initially understand.
Yeah.
It's the first time that the film really launches into the Cronenbergian body horror that people were sort of saying it was about. James Cameron talks about the recency effect, where the thing that happens in the last 20 minutes of a movie is all you carry away. That's the strongest impression, is the last part of the film you've seen. So people came out of it and it's like, oh, it's about body horror. And it's like, well, yeah, but not in that way until it is. And then it's just such a graceful way of tying together every single dangling idea and thread in that sequence. And it's just so vivid when it does happen. But yeah, she's trying to do the thing she can't do. Finding out why is horrifying for both of them and for us.
Yeah. In the end, she's the prey.
Yeah.
In the last sequence, everything changes. From the time that she's not able to have sex until the end, you're just making me realize, you know, the next sexual experience is playing on this idea of kind of like a more traditional horror movie where young woman, Forrest, meets somebody she shouldn't.
Yeah.
And then is attacked.
Yeah. You know? And it's bizarre because the...
And is killed. I mean, she's murdered.
Yeah,
I mean,
she loses.
She's murdered by this random man who we haven't even seen in the movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's a definite kind of like what males are in the movie versus what females are. Yeah. It's very strange.
But that she should die by the same happenstance that she was killing everyone else is really fascinating to me. Even though it was completely
random
different,
pickup.
It's just a pickup. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the sense too that we are like conflicted about this at the end, because I mean, I don't know, this guy might just have saved the world for all we know.
Yeah,
like, if she's the only one, and she's not, because there's the motorcyclist and all the other stuff is happening, but from her perspective, like, we just watched an invasion get stopped somehow, and we were rooting for the invasion for a while.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of remarkable the way that we are seduced by the film itself.
Yeah, 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 and that, I think, probably more than anything, is what I was trying to do with O Negative. I wanted to sort of use the idea of hero... And the thing that the permission that you give over to the person through which you're seeing the world and all the events of the movie, and I wanted to continually pull back at the idea of, do you agree with this guy?
Yeah.
And I think the shots, the kind of, you know, we obviously didn't do hidden camera kind of stuff, but those same ideas of not having access to someone's facial expression. And not explaining exactly what they should be thinking. No dialogue helps you kind of like... It allows... For me, what Under the Skin did that I wanted to emulate with O Negative was to use what the viewer supplies.
Right.
Nothing is explained in Under the Skin. I mean, Under the Skin is a feature, so it has, you know, much more of a sort of an idea of what the story is. In a short, I think you can sort of sketch out a little bit more and be a little bit even more elliptical. But I definitely wanted to play with the idea of you're going to bring your own idea of what these things mean and what the motivations are behind them. And it's the variety of people ascribing intention or thought to the characters that I've presented in O Negative, which I have no idea of what they're thinking. You know, I just was like, here's this happens, and then this happens, and this will be cool if this happens, and then tease out that thing. And as soon as they know what's going to happen, what happens if you let out the line and pause before you cut to the reveal of who else is in the room? Like things like that were definitely, you know, things that I learned from Under the Skin, because you do, you allow, because of what you've been trained to do through movies, I think viewers allow a lot of leeway to being inside the hero's head and sort of giving their own thoughts to them and giving their own sympathies to them, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of the... I mean, I've been watching the feedback on The Force Awakens just because it's been...
I haven't seen it yet.
It's been so loud that everyone is complaining about... Well, people are complaining about people complaining about the female lead being the lead. Mm. And it all boils down to, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, right.
And it's just such this weird identification. It's like, the whole point of a movie is that you get to watch someone else do stuff. you don't... They don't have to... I was having a conversation with somebody who's about 23, 24, and it was just about how all television really has to reflect what he wants. And it's unconscious. He doesn't know this. Mm. He doesn't know that that's what his argument is. But he kept coming back to, that show... He didn't say that show's not really for me, which is what he was trying
to say. So it's not good.
He was saying, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm,
and it's like, well, you're a kid, though.
you don't... What the hell do you know?
the idea that everything... And Star Wars is theoretically that example, right? And the whole of the series is supposed to appeal to children, which is what George Lucas keeps telling us. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you might have to watch somebody... Ooh, there's a black guy. I have to look at a black guy? What? Or a girl? I mean, like, the idea that that's a thing in genre, that that's a science fiction
complaint. How dare they? Yeah. How dare they sort of go to that politically correct or whatever they think that the reason is?
And J.J. Abrams just said, you know, like, I wanted to make a movie that looks like The World I See, which I think is such a beautiful thing to say about anything, any kind of art.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, he wasn't pandering to California farm boys or white guys in general. I'm just like, what else do you have? Show me more things. That's interesting to me. And the idea that you need to understand explicitly why someone does something if it's not something you would do is ridiculous.
Mm.
That's the whole point of film, is empathy, right? You're supposed to learn about the world, and even through the eyes of a vampire or an alien or whatever it is, there's still an experience being had that is different from your own. That's why you're watching it.
Well, I mean... There's the question of what is the philosophy of why we watch things, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people... I was listening to Charlie Kaufman, the sort of screenwriting BAFTA speech yesterday. Yeah. Someone recommended it to me, who I have to remember and thank them, because, you know, his whole question to the audience was, I'm not here to tell you what the best way to do this. I'm not here to tell you how to win this game. And I think for a lot of people, the idea that somehow they are entering into a contract where they might find out something other than what they know is like anathema. And I think so many people want a product that is exactly as digestible as the last thing that they understood. And anything that sort of contradicts that or knocks them off balance, is something to be fought against.
Yeah.
And that includes, I guess, in this situation, the hero being a female, you know, which is so, you know, I don't know why we think we're sort of, you know, progressing as a society, but there seems to be that idea that somehow we would be past that, and it doesn't seem like that's going to be the case anytime soon.
Well, I mean, it made $1 billion.
So yeah, well,
presumably that's true. Most people are okay with it.
Yeah.
I think it's great. It just means people have to try harder to yell, to yell louder.
Yeah, or maybe those are the voices that seem to be heard, or, you know, those the complaining voices are strongest.
Yeah.
On the internet, at least.
Well, let's make them watch Under the Skin. That'll keep them quiet. So angry. Well,
let's hope.
A girl wouldn't do that.
Yes, I can't wait to... Do you have comments on your page?
sometimes, but very rarely. Like, people leave reviews on iTunes, but it's never about the movie specifically. Well, one about Ronan. That was fun. But everyone seems to like it, so that's nice.
Well, that's good. That's good.
But yeah, I usually close with the question of artistic influence, like what have you borrowed or stolen, but we've kind of dealt with that.
Yeah, that's true.
Influence is there. So... How would you pitch Under the Skin to someone? How would you sell it to someone?
Boy, I'm so bad at selling things. that's why I've got to find a producer to make the O negative feature. I think I would sell it. I would be careful of who I chose to sell it to. I would say, if you're the kind of person who wants to be immersed in a pseudo genre exercise about seeing the world through an alien lens, if you like the world of sort of like making things strange, if you like The Shining, if you like the feeling of discomfort, of being involved in a hero that might be kind of doing things that you are you think are awful or terrible or morally reprehensible, then I think this could be a movie for you. I think you have to like the idea of movies as dreams and things that you enter into that don't have to be A plus B equals C kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think if you like the kind of weird, kind of crazy math of the logarithms of the poetry and the strangeness of sort of the nightmare of what it would be to sort of encounter Scarlett Johansson on the street and be taken back with her, then I think you like Under the Skin.
Yeah, that's a pretty good pitch. Mm. Also, you know, just generally, is to boil it down, don't get into cars with strange women.
Apparently.
Men, or anyone,
really. Or men, yeah. That's probably going to be the lesson of my movie, too.
My thanks to Steve McCarthy, whose short film O Negative screens Friday, January 15th at the TIFF Bell Lightbox in Canada's Top 10 Shorts program number 2. You should check it out. You'll also be seeing him later this year as an actor in Andrew Curry's upcoming comedy The Steps, and I don't think it constitutes a spoiler to say he's the best thing in that film, and in Roger Christian's Joseph and Mary. You can find Steve on Twitter at R for Burning, the letter R, the number 4, and the word Burning, named for his production company, Candles Are for Burning. And you can find Under the Skin on Blu-ray and DVD from Lionsgate in the US and Mongrel Media in Canada. It's also available for sale on iTunes, and in the US you can find it on Amazon Prime. In Canada, it's streaming on Netflix and for sale or rental on Google Play. But however you watch it in HD. It's important. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, please do not accompany it with screechy cello music. That's just creepy. But thanks for listening. Happy New Year, everybody.